Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so time to begin. I want to begin with comments that were made last class. I was asked about, we saw something interesting that Kunitz, he only studied with Wolf Boskowitz when he was like from age 10 to 13, yet he regards himself as a student and other people regard him as a student. And I said that you have other examples of where great figures studied very young with a teacher, a master, and they are regarded as a student, and they regard themselves as a student. I was especially thinking of during the era when people would get married at age 17 or 18. Today, we might not regard a student as one, really as a student, unless he studies with them at age 17, 18, 19, 20. But 300-400 years ago, people got married much sooner. So I was asked to find some examples. I'll just give you a couple of examples. Truthfully, I looked a bit, and a number of the examples which I could give, the people who studied, no one would have ever heard of the rabbi they studied with. But I was interested in focusing on great rabbis with students who are also known as great. And let me correct something about Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. I said that he only studied at age 17. At Slobodka. It's not true. It was actually 19. But let me give you two examples. And as we go through the semester, I'll find more examples as I'm reading. One is the Ramchal, Moshe Chaim Wotzato, about whom we'll speak a good deal when we go on our summer trip, God willing, this summer to Italy. His teacher, he's from Padua, which is right near Venice. As I said, we won't be going to Padua, but we'll be passing right by it, so I'll speak about Padua. His teacher was Isaiah Yeshaya Bassan, the Mahari Bassan. If you know the history of the Ramchal, this was his teacher who stood by him, who defended him. And Rav Moshe Chaim Wotzato always regarded him as his, not just as his Rebbe Muvhak, really his only teacher. He studied with them, getting the exact years here, from 1715 to 1722. That means from age 7 to age 14. The Ramchal dies at age 39. He doesn't live that long. But this very important figure in the Ramchal's life, his Rebbe, he never studied with him after the age of 14 because the Mahari Bassan left and went somewhere else. He went to a different city. Let me give you some other examples. These are from the Chassam Sofer. One of the Chassam Sofer's teachers, who he calls him his Rebbe, he speaks very highly of him, is Rav Meshulam Zalman Chassid, in Frankfurt. The Chassam Sofer begins learning with Meshulam Zalman at age 6, and I believe that by age 9, when he transfers to Rav Nosson Adler, that is it. See, he had no more study under him. Then at age 13, he studies with the Hafla, Rav Pinchas Horowitz, who becomes he's only a student of his officially about a year. And then he goes from the age of 14 to 16, he learns with Rav Tevela Scheuer, and he regards all these as his teachers. Now with Rav Pinchas Horowitz, it's a more complicated a bit, because he comes back to Frankfurt when he's 16, and Rav Pinchas Horowitz is still the Rav there. So it could be that informally he had dealings with him, so you can say that he still remains a student of his. But he was not an official student of his, and as I said, Rav Meshulam Zalman Chassid, from the age of 6, he becomes his student. So with that, let us move on. We're in the middle of dealing with Moshe Kunitz. Let me get rid of his picture here. I don't know if I shared with you. Here's another picture. I don't know if I shared with you. There's another picture of his. As I said last week, I have another picture of his, which I hope to publish soon. We ended last class by me saying that he goes to Breslau, and he publishes a book called Mosto Tevel, he's 20 years old, which is a commentary on the Agadah, and I mentioned how the Maskilim had a lot of negative things to say about the Agadah, so here is someone with a more enlightened viewpoint. It was important for him to show how Talmudic Agadah can be interpreted in a more respectful fashion. He then publishes a commentary on the Bechinat Olam of Rav Yedaya HaPanini, this Rishon, which is a moralistic work in prose and poetry, and he writes a commentary on it. By now, he returns to Buddha, or Abuda, and he has a very good reputation among the open-minded Jews. I'm not going to call them Maskilim because they weren't called that yet, but just more the open-minded Jews. And a rich man in Abuda, which as I said is north of Buda and Pesht, offers his daughter to Kunitz. He works in this business for a while. Unfortunately, he goes bankrupt, and he's forced to become a dayan in Pesht, as well as before that he was a rav and a darshan in Abuda. And he writes a number of books, and let's deal with a little of that, with them a little bit. He's known, however, for one document. He's best known for one document of all of two pages. I think I have, here's the title page. This book, which we spoke about when we dealt with the Chasam Sofer. When the early reformers were getting going, they published a work of a halachic text, that is Eliezer Lieberman. Those who were not with us last semester, you can listen into the classes on the Chasam Sofer. We deal with this. Eliezer Lieberman in Berlin, who is a reformer, wants to solicit rabbinic approval of various reforms. And we have no idea how many rabbis he wrote to. He definitely wasn't going to get much approval in Germany and in Moravia and places like that, in Bohemia. And we don't know even outside those countries how many people turned him down. But he was able to get approval for various reforms, or certain reforms, from two rabbis in Italy, from Aaron Chorin Acher, who we spoke about a good deal last semester, and from Moshe Kunitz. If you see here, the bottom name on the title page there is Moshe Kunitz. So most people who know anything about Moshe Kunitz, and this is why he's famous, know that he wrote a letter in support of the reformers. Well, how could a Rav, a traditional Rav, write a letter in support of the reformers? The same question goes for the two rabbis from Italy, one of whom was a significant posek, the Rav of Verona, Rav Yaakov Chai Recanati, published a book called Piskei Recanati. In fact, some people go so far as to include Kunitz among the early reformers, which isn't true at all. And the proof of this is, there's a lot of proofs, but the best proof is if you were with our summer trip last summer, on our summer trip, 2011, we saw Rav Moshe Kunitz's grave. It is right on the rabbinic row, sitting next to Rav Shimon Oppenheim, he's a pilgrimage spot for all the Hasidim, and from Yisrael Warman. He's right there with all the great rabbanim. So the fact that he wrote this letter did not take away from his rabbinic standing. But we still need to explain what's going on here. First of all, let me mention the letter that he wrote. Well, the letter that he wrote was in response to a letter by this Eliezer Lieberman, this reformer in Berlin, in which he says to Kunitz and the rest that this new synagogue we've established has adopted three reforms. Reform number one, it prays in the Sephardic pronunciation. This is something that, from our standpoint, our day and age, doesn't sound like much of a reform at all. We have many synagogues in which they pray in the Sephardic pronunciation, simply because many of the day schools teach Sephardic pronunciation. And if they were Zionist synagogues, they do Sephardic pronunciation. But that was the first reform. This, among the early reformers, they had this love affair with the Sephardic world, thinking the Ashkenazic world is obscurantist and closed-minded, but the Sephardic world is very open-minded, so what do? You pray like a Sephardi. The second reform is that they don't do the silent Amida. They just they recite it together out loud with the Chazan, and then after Kedusha, the Chazan continues reciting it out loud. This, too, we've spoken about in the past, is, although it's a reform, but it's not such a crazy reform, the Rambam already recommended doing this. And to this day, you have synagogues, Moroccan synagogues in Israel, that continue this practice. The reason of the Rambam was that people did not pay attention to the repetition of Shmona Esrei. Okay, so those are the two small reforms, I think you can call them. The third question they ask him is that this shul in Berlin sings some songs and recites some prayers with an organ on Shabbos played by a non-Jew. So why are they writing to Kunitz? Well, aside from the fact that Kunitz was known to be somewhat open-minded, and as I mentioned, We have no idea how many people they wrote to who did not reply. Kunitz was also a friend of Aaron Horin, Acher. At this time, when Aaron Horin wrote the responsa that appear, his responsa appears here, the third one, called Kinata Emet, he was not regarded as a Reform rabbi. He was a traditional rabbi when he wrote this responsa that created a lot of controversy, and he even retracted what he wrote in a letter to the Chasam Sofer. There were people who had suspicions over him, as we spoke about last semester, because of his permission to eat sturgeon. However, this permission to eat sturgeon, which became a big dispute, and he published, if I'm not mistaken, he had two separate booklets on it, was in defense of his teacher. The Notabi Yehuda permitted sturgeon, and there were great rabbis, including the Notabi Yehuda's son and the Eleazar Fleckels and others, who supported Aaron Horin. So when this responsum was written in the early 19th century, Horin was not regarded as a reformer. And just to, I know we have some new people with us, so if I can go back just for 1 second, I'll show you that. Here is the proof that it wasn't just reformers, who I showed you this last semester, but because of the new people, I'll show you quickly. Here we have the letter of the Agudas HaRabbanim in America, the list of their kosher fish, and lo and behold, you have sturgeon there. And as I said, swordfish also, which was eaten. Sturgeon was listed as a kosher fish from Jews in America. And for those who read Yiddish, I'll show it again. This is the ad that appeared multiple times in Hapardes. I think it was perhaps kosher for, well, I don't know how many years. 15 years later, they were no longer running a kosher. But here you can see an ad in the Rabbinic Monthly, Hapardes, where all the great rabbis in America wrote in that the sturgeon is a is regarded as a kosher fish. It's very tasty, and you can get it at Johnson's Smoked Fish. As I mentioned, Kunitz was quite friendly with Horin. Horin wrote a book published in 1803 called, he was the Rav of the city of Arad in Hungary, called Emek HaShaveh. And this book also has liberal ideas. Nothing reform, but liberal. And Horin has a haskama for it. He also writes a poem for this book. He calls Horin Ish Brito, you know, his dear friend. So it could be that Horin suggested to write to Kunitz. In his approbation, Kunitz describes Horin as following in the path of Rav Sadia Gaon, the Rambam, the Ramah, and others. In other words, open-minded types. He says the Rashba also. I don't know why the Rashba is regarded as open-minded. The Rashba was opposed to the study of philosophy, although he wasn't entirely opposed. He was opposed to the study it for people who were not ready for it. And the Ramah, Moshe Isserles, he studied philosophy. He wrote a book on philosophy, so that's why he mentions them. Okay, what about the questions he answers? In answer to the first question, Kunitz speaks in favor of the Sephardic pronunciation, noting that most of the world's Jews use it, and he mentions the famous story that we've spoken about already a few times, how Rabbi Nassim Adler, the Chasam Sofer's teacher, adopted the Sephardic pronunciation, seeing it as more exact. Responding to the second question of what we call today the Hecha Kedusha, the abridged where you write, you recite Kedusha, and then the Chazan continues on, he doesn't approve of this. And he explains, no, so he's stringent here, that you should not get rid of it. Well, what about having a non-Jew play an organ on Shabbos? Well, when you think of it, what's wrong with a non-Jew playing an organ on Shabbos? Well, what possible prohibition is there for a non-Jew to play it? We know that non-Jews played instruments on Shabbos, although today, if you tried to do this, they'd call you a reformer, they'd throw you out, but all you have to do is look in the Shulchan Aruch, look in the Berahetev and the other commentaries. They describe the practice of having a wedding Friday afternoon and then having the Suda Smitzvah on Friday night, which was a good thing because the poor people were all invited, and having non-Jews play the instruments on Shabbos for you. So this was done. We have other examples of where they describe non-Jews playing instruments. I believe one example, if I'm not mistaken, is they were a new Sefer Torah. The first time it was opened was on Shabbos, and there was a procession, and you had non-Jews playing instruments. But in any event, what's the problem with a non-Jew playing an instrument on Shabbos? The reformers thought that this would be a very nice thing. In fact, they knew that this was a practice. This had been done in Italy, where they used an organ with a non-Jew. So there was an organ in the Prague Shul, the Altneu Shul, although it wasn't played on Shabbos. But still, so what's the issue? Kunitz begins his reply describing how music has a long tradition in Judaism. Even the prophets, Elisha, is described as being given prophecy when the musicians played. And he says, and this is his claim to fame, he says that music can attract those who have distanced themselves from the shul. It can stir the hearts of the women and children to love God. There, and he says, the practice is that we have non-Jews light candles in the synagogue on Shabbos. If the candle goes out on Shabbos, the general practice is, among all shuls, that a non-Jew, a Shabbos goy, will come and light the candles. So if we permit that, which some people said was forbidden, but we are lenient on that, he rules certainly it's permissible to have a non-Jew play an organ for a Jew. This responsum was strongly rejected. The so-called Orthodox rabbis saw that these so-called halachic questions were just a ploy, and it was, they were correct. Another 15, 20 years, none of the reformers were at all interested in halacha. This was maybe a 20, 30 year span, and they understood that you cannot give in and you cannot change the customs and the practices. However, Moses' Kunitz's heter, his permission to play the organ with a non-Jew, was adopted in Hungary by the Neolog congregations. That's the right-wing conservative, what we would say they regard as right-wing conservative synagogues. Until World War II, and even after World War II, these Neolog synagogues, men and women always sat separately. Women sat in balconies. The sitter was the exact same. The only difference was that these synagogues had an organ always played by a non-Jew. If you go today to the Dohani Shul, you will see an organ played by a non-Jew. Last summer, I took the group to the shul. Our minyan, the Orthodox minyan, was starting at 6:25. The Dohani shul was starting 6, I think it was. So we went to the Dohani shul first because I had been there 3 weeks before, and it's really something to see the organ and get a sense of what it was like. But to show you that they have frumkeit in their own way, they didn't play the organ at Shabbos. I know everyone was disappointed. Why not? I asked the rabbi afterwards. It was sfira. Particularly, I don't know why, if you play the organ at Shabbos, well, you can't play the organ on Shabbos, because there shouldn't be the Avegos on Shabbos of Sfira. But to be that as it may, their practice is not to play the organ on Sfira, something which, if you go in this country, I don't think, forget reform, I don't think there's a conservative shul in this country anymore that still holds from Sfira. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, I look at the New York Times every year, Sfira. At the wedding section, you don't have any Orthodox people getting married, obviously. You have conservative people getting married all the time. It's not relevant to them. And here in the Dohani Shul, to this day, they won't play the organ on Sfira, but they do have the organ based upon this permission of Rav Moshe Kunitz. They have made another change right now, except for the high holidays, because the community is so small. They have brought the women down. The women sit separately from the men, but they sit on the same level, off to the side. It's probably halachic machitza even, or perhaps. So we're dealing really with a right-wing conservative approach, although in American conservative Judaism, no one would ever dream of using an organ, because this was regarded as a thing for the reformers or something in the church. But it's interesting that in Hungary, the Neolog synagogues, they kept this permission, and they thought that this is 100% halachically valid to play the organ with the non-Jew. And despite this letter to the reformers, most of the Gedolim, not all the Gedolim, but most of the Gedolim still treated him with respect. There is a negative comment of the Chasam Sofer about him, but it's not about the organ. It's about that at the beginning of another one of his books, he talks about how all the negative comments of the sages about non-Jews don't apply to the Jews we're living in, non-Jews we're living among today. And he really meant it. It's not just, you know, when you see other books, you have three lines saying that all these negative comments apply to pagans of old. He has an entire page here. He calls it Moda'ah. And in there, I mean, he goes into details. So the Chasam Sofer had no doubt that he meant it, and therefore he attacks him for this. But the Rav of Hamburg, who led the attack against the reformers, who organized the publication of this book, I'll pull it up right now, that we spoke about last semester, Ela Divrei Habrit, which is all the rabbis against reform, the Basin of Hamburg, he writes to the Chasam Sofer, expressing surprise that Kunitz, who was known as a tzaddik and a Talmud Chacham, would have contributed to the Noga HaTzedek. And I think the answer is clear. He fell into their trap. He gets a letter from someone who he doesn't know in Berlin, asking him this question, and he responds, not knowing the context. The same thing with the Italian rabbis. They were asked specific questions. Is it permissible to daven in Nusach Sephardic pronunciation, let's say? Is it permissible to have a non-Jew play the organ? They didn't know that this was all part of a context in which traditional Judaism was being assaulted step by step. So that's how I think we can explain what Kunitz is doing responding to this. Now, Kunitz's major work, very, very interesting work. It was unavailable for a long, long time. Here it is. It's called the Ben Yochai. It does a few things in this book. This book, incidentally, was published, you can see it there, in Vienna in 1815. It was unavailable for many, many years. It was reprinted. I'm holding the reprint here. In 1991 by the Satmar. So the book is not regarded as a problematic book, and especially in the Sephardic world, the Palachis and others, they cite it a lot. What is this book, though? I encourage everyone to check it out on HebrewBooks.org. You can order a bound copy if you want. Well, first of all, as it says, you can read it here, to explain the secrets or the inner meanings of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. He mentions every passage of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai in the Talmud and Midrash and Halachic literature. Furthermore, a significant section of the book is an attack, an assault, and that's the cave, incidentally, of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, if you see there, if you know the story. Another part of the book, and the one that's most famous and most people refer to it for this, is it is an attack on Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, in his book Mipachat Sfarim, argues, if you take him at his word, he argues that while the Zohar has authentic teachings going back to Rashi Ben Yochai, much of the book, most of the book, the overall majority of the book, it's hard to know, is a medieval forgery. Some people think that his pious statements at the beginning, that really the Zohar is holy, it just has a lot of phony additions, is just to take the pressure off him, but he assumed that the entire Zohar is a fraudulent book. And he was a Makubal, a Kabbalist, but he still writes against the Zohar. So, significant section, as I said, of this book is a defense of the Zohar. Truthfully, the defense of the Zohar is to say it's weak is putting it mildly. It's extremely weak. Just to give you an example, it's apologetics. That's all it is. Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, the later rabbi of Prague, has a whole little booklet against Kunitz. Just to give you one example, the very beginning of Emden's Mipachat Sfarim, he points out that the Zohar uses the word, a Spanish word, esnoga, for synagogue. And, it's obvious that it's using a word which wouldn't have existed in the days of the Tanaim. But Kunitz tries to argue that really this is an Aramaic word, and no one could take that seriously. What is valuable about the book is he includes, at the end, every example of where Kabbalistic concerns or Kabbalistic ideas influence the halakha in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Beis Yosef, in the commentaries on the side of the page, and it goes by Siman in Shulchan Aruch. Any example. Now, the Shulchan Aruch, only one time, actually, mentions in the Shulchan Aruch Kabbalistic ideas. In the Beis Yosef, I'll cite the Zohar, but in the Shulchan Aruch, he mentions Kabbalistic ideas once, but there are many practices in the Shulchan Aruch, and the Beis Yosef that are based on Kabbalistic things, and the Ben Yochai is still very valuable. He also claims that every halacha recorded in the name of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is accepted by us, and everything recorded in the name of Rabbi Shimon is not necessarily accepted. He assumes that every time Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is mentioned, that's when he came out of the cave. The bar Yochai is added. I'm skeptical of all this, and I don't think there's any real evidence, but that's his major thesis, that the bar Yochai appears on statements added after he came out of the cave. The most Kunitz will say is that there are a few later interpolations, things added to the Zohar. But to think that any of the ideas and the important sections are added later, that he rejects. In fact, the Chasam Sofer says that it's one of the amazing things in this world that you would expect Kunitz to write to Mitpachat Sarim, designed to disprove the Zohar, and Emden to defend the Zohar. But it's just the reverse. I don't know why Chasam Sofer saw this as so amazing, and I don't even know if he said this, but that's what he's quoted as saying. The reason that I say I don't know if he said it is because in the Tshuvos, the Chasam Sofer cites the Mitpachat Sfarim and accepts what the Mitpachat Sfarim says. That is, he thinks that the Emden is correct in showing that there's all these post-Rashbi forgeries. And he himself said, the Chasam Sofer, that is, that if you took what's authentic to Rosh Shimon bar Yochai in the Zohar, you'd have a very, very small book. Yeah, I understand, but I mean, it's from Rav Shimon Sofer, if I recall correctly. But I'm not sure. I mean, maybe it's a joke. I don't know. But where can we find that quote? The quote of the Chasam Sofer is in one of his tshuvot. If you email me, I'll send it to you. He refers to Yaakov Emden as a Navi and says, the Navi has spoken. And the quote that if you took away the post-Zoharic editions, the Zohar would be a small booklet. That I cited already in one of my blog posts. It's quoted by one of his students, and the book where it's quoted in has a haskama from the Shevet Sofer, so there's no question that it's authentic. But I can get you all the details later. One of his other books, post-Zoharic editions with an A. I mean, post-Rashbi, I should say. Thank you. Post Rav Shimon bar Yochai editions. That is, if you took away everything that is actually post-Tanaitic, the Chasam Sofer says you'd actually have a very small booklet. And that is in line with what he says in the responsum, where he quotes Yaakov Emden and speaks positively about what he says in the Mitpachat Sfarim. There were three Gedolim at this time who, quite surprisingly, had very negative things to say about the Zohar. One is Yaakov Emden, and then you have the Chasam Sofer, so that's the second one. And then you have the third one, which is the Tshuva Me'ava, Elazar Fleckelis, who really just says that we don't know who wrote the Zohar, we can't rely on the Zohar. And for a long time, no one really knew where Tshuva Me'ava Fleckelis, whose grave we also saw last summer, where he got these ideas from, but now we know. Because last year, an unpublished sermon, Drasha of the Note of Yehuda, appeared in print. When I say unpublished, it's not really true. It was published in the Drushei Tzlach, in the Drashot. However, they cut out certain big sections. Now we have the original, and the whole Drasha is published. And he goes to town attacking the Zohar. First he attacks the Maskilim and the Deists. There are a lot of those in Prague. And then he starts attacking the Mekubalim, and he attacks the Zohar as well. So if you read what the Note of Yehuda says, his student, the Tshuva Me'ava, it's almost, he's citing him almost word for word, the same sort of ideas. All the references are in my article, the Hebrew article on in the Milan Chavivin on the Zohar. Yes, exactly, Baruch, thank you. We only knew about this relatively recently. It's created a bit of a controversy because there's a nice, good scholar in New York named Sharon Flato, who did a Yale PhD on the Note of Yehuda, published a very nice book by Littman Library, and she deals a lot with his approach to Kabbalah. The problem is she didn't have access to this text. And this has now become a big issue because how many of her conclusions need to be revised based on this text, because although the Notabi Yehuda was a Mekubal, or I shouldn't say Mekubal, although he was aware of Kabbalah and was involved with it, I don't know if we can call him a Mekubal, to see him really respond very harshly to the Zohar, that could cause some reevaluation, unless you say, as she would want, she wants to say, if you read a reply to Alan Nadler, that you have to take things in context. And that's always the case. When you have lots of sources showing him involved with Kabbalah and citing the Zohar, and then you have this one drasha where he really attacks it, it's a question of how you weigh things. Although it's possible also there's elements of dating here, that he changed his mind over time. It needs further investigation. Another book of Kunitz is known as Beit Rabbi. Let me see if I have... Well, Beit Rabbi is the... hold on, let me see if I have the title page here. I don't have the title page, but I'm going to show you something just as interesting. It's a biography of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Well, first, it's in two parts. It's a biography of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and the second part is a play. Another example of how Kunitz is not the typical rabbinic figure. Here's the whole second section. You can see it finds on HebrewBooks.org. Here is the beginning of the second section. The first section, the much smaller section, is just the biography, and the second section is a play. Here is the cast of characters. Right at the top is Rebbe, Nasi Beit Yisrael, and then the rest of these characters. Where does a great rabbi come out writing a play? As he mentions in the introduction, the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Watzlawick, was also a playwright. But still, this isn't something you could ever imagine the Chasam Sofer, the Novi Yehuda, or anyone like that writing a play. It shows his open-mindedness, and he wanted to express certain ideas by way of a narrative, a play. This is something where you would see German Orthodox figures do. Not just plays. Later on, Yitzhak Breuer writes a new Kuzari, and it's an open-minded way of looking at things. This biography of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, until recently, was found in the introduction to every edition of the Vilna Mishnayos, the Ram edition, the Vilna Mishnayos. In the new edition, the Wagshel edition, this has been removed. I mean, the original edition was read by tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people since the 19th century. No one ever found a problem with it. What could be the problem with it? I believe that someone must have pointed out to the Wagshel publishers that Kunitz, there's some problems with him. Maybe they didn't even know what they were, but they heard talk, and therefore they just removed it. And I mentioned in my post when I dealt with this that it's very ironic, because the text right after Kunitz, which the Ram publishers put in, was by a Maskil named Lowenson. Now, the Ram publishers had a lot of Maskilim involved with them. This is a real Maskil, and in this work, he has a note in which he says the Ecclesiastes was definitely not written by Solomon. So that stays in, but Kunitz was taken out. I'm going to return to this passage in the introduction in the future, in my future writing posts, because I've now found that there's another edition that leaves Kunitz's introduction in, but takes out about the equivalent of two paragraphs. What does it take out? So if anyone's listening to me and you then go searching and find it, please don't put it on your blogs or anything, because I want to use it. And at the end of the introduction, he refers to a figure, Rambaman, Resh Mem Bet Mem Nun. That's Mendelssohn. In fact, I'll tell you what was so problematic that had to be censored. They didn't censor the entire thing because it's a very nice introduction. He talks about how in our day and age, even the non-Jews are coming to appreciate the genius of the sages and of the Mishnah. And he says that the Mishnah was recently, he means about a few decades ago, translated into German. And the Chacham HaMafursam, the great wise man, the Chacham, which is, by the way, how the Chasam Sofer calls Mendelssohn. He calls him a Chacham. The Chacham of Forsan Mendelssohn corrected the translation in various places. And then he says, and I think this is what caused him to take it out, I would not be surprised that if Rebbe saw such a translation in his lifetime, he would be very happy, because Rebbe respected and loved wisdom and different languages. And he knew how to speak different languages. Romit, that's Latin, Yavanit, Greek, and Hebrew. And he didn't like Aramaic, it says, in the Talmud. So the fact that Kunitz mentions Mendelssohn and mentions how, what a nice thing it was that, the Mishnah is now translated into German, and the non-Jews, are respectful of it, and he mentions his name Mendelssohn with Zichrono Livracha after his name, that was probably too much, and that whole section, was removed. Yes, Yidol, good point. I'm gonna get to the Oza Hadar edition as well. The question is, did they know what they were doing or not? The other ironic thing is someone pointed out to me, I said that if the people knew what was in this Lowenson's Aramaic grammar, they would have censored the whole thing. It turns out that I didn't examine it carefully enough. Someone pointed out the problematic footnote has been completely rewritten. That is, they changed a word or two, I shouldn't say completely rewritten. A couple words were changed, so it means something entirely different. I will show all this in a future post. So that shows that they are aware of it. But yes, they could have changed Rambaman Mendelssohn to Ramban. Well, Mendelssohn, who's called Chacham by the Chacham Sofer, Chacham Moshe Midesau, actually doesn't call him Russia. Chacham. He calls him, in his ethical will, he refers to him as R, Reish Mem Dalid, but in other places he calls him a Chacham. And the Levi Ivri, Kivios Schlesinger, says that Reb Moshe Midesau. It stands for Russia Moshe Desau. And other people say it really shouldn't be a Reish. If you look at the original, it's a little stretched out. It's a Chet, so it should be a Chacham Moshe Desau. And others say, no, he wouldn't even call him a Chacham. So it really is Sifrei Chemed. Don't read like love stories. But we have the original the original ethical will. Mayor Hildesheim republished it. He even sent it to detective division of the Israel police force, and they investigate. They examine it very carefully to see if anything was added later. You know, they have technology that can determine whether the ink is from the same period or added later. And there's no question that there's the two squiggly marks there, and it's not Sifrei Chemed. Yes, you say Shlomo just put out the book, working very hard on it. Actually, this is not even going to be in it, I don't think. Let me mention a few examples of his responsa. The responsa is called Hamatzaref. At least I think that's how it's pronounced. Sometimes some people have transliterated it as Hamatzaref, but I don't know what that means. I believe it's Hamatzaref. Here's what it looks like, the title page. Only volume 1 is available on HebrewBooks.org, but I found a volume 2 on Google Books, and I had it printed for me, a very nice little printing. The problem is I don't know how to make it go right to left. It prints left to right, but I have everything. Unfortunately, the Mitzaref volume 1, the pages are a bit out of order. Everything's there, just a little out of order. This is a very strange volume of responsa. And you get a sense of the tenor of the man. Well, first of all, just in number two, volume two, he says something which shows you his Haskalah tendencies, that he says that it's important to study Tanakh. Everyone needs to study Tanakh. Not long after this, Rav Shlomo Kluger writes about how you shouldn't study Tanakh. That's a Haskalah thing. But let me begin with the chapter with book volume one. On page 141, he tells us something which itself is valuable. Without it, Jacob Neusner used to say that if you find one thing of value in a book, then it's worthwhile. He said this because he would publish, for everything he did, he'd publish like 10 books just focused on the exact same thing, but he said he always put one new idea in there. I don't want to buy 10 books and say for one idea in each book, but if only this one thing. He mentions that his forefather, the Maharal, remember we mentioned last time that he's descended from the Maharal, would recite Birkas Achama without a blessing. This testimony is not found anywhere else. It's quoted, by the way, by Rabbi Akiva Eger in his notes on Shulchan Aruch. The problem is that this idea, this Birkas HaChama, which we said was 2 years ago, I think, this is a post-Talmudic blessing. Anyone who's been to yeshiva knows, so they tell us that we can't make our own brachas. We can't use Hashem's name and make our own blessings. The truth of the matter is, like many things you learn in yeshiva, common knowledge, it's false. There's a whole book written on these sorts of brachas that are post-Talmudic brachas. Every morning we say post-Talmudic brachas. Forget the women's bracha, Shasali Kirtzono. Hanosein Layaf Koach is a post-Talmudic bracha. There's plenty of examples. Rosh Chodesh, Halon Rosh Chodesh. So this is a red herring, this idea, according to many, that you can't make blessings on post-Talmudic blessings. And the proof is that we made a blessing on Birkas HaChama, but the Maharal didn't make a blessing. The fact that we do make a blessing shows that most people disagree with the Maharal and think the standard psak is that we can make a blessing on a post-Talmudic bracha, we can make a blessing on a minhag. I think what people would say today is, well, it's one thing if the Rishonim or the Gaonim established a blessing and made it and then we could do it. However, who are we? We're not of the quality or the caliber that we can institute such a blessing. And you can't make a blessing on Yom HaTzmaot or anything like that. Could be. Maybe that's correct. But you still have to explain what's the structural difference between people who live in the year 1000 and people who live in the year 1500. Why for one it's okay and one for not it's okay. We understand why Talmudic sages can do things that post-Talmudic sages can't. But it does seem this is quite artificial because in the year 1000 they weren't regarded as Rishonim. In the year 1000, they were just regarded as the contemporary sages. Shoma, I think Chol Rosh Chodesh is post-Talmudic, but I'm doing this ad hoc here. But I will email me and I'll get back to you on this. I'm pretty sure that Chol Rosh Chodesh is only minhag. And it's not halacha. So we have Talmud Chachamim to check, and I will... check it later tonight. I'm pretty certain about this, but being that I'm sitting here doing this all from memory, I can't be 100% certain. On a bracha with a bracha. On page 140 of the Mitzaref, he says that it's permitted to embalm the dead. And he cites other authorities who disagree with him. I've gone back to this, I've mentioned this in previous classes as well. If I'm not mistaken, Greenwald in his book discusses this. And since I mentioned Greenwald, we have Machokas, Yidol, and Shlomo, but I hold like Yidol. It's always good to hold like people that agree with you. But in all seriousness, I'm pretty sure I'm right about this, but then thank you, Yidol. Greenwald has a book, this Yekusiel, Leopold Greenwald, called Mekorot Lekorot Yisrael, full of interesting historical stuff. This Greenwald, who we've spoken about so many times, was such an interesting person. In there, I found on page 27, he reports that, continuing up to his day, that in Prague, Kunitz's name is mentioned among other Gedol Yisrael during Yisra. In other words, they thought Kunitz was significant that they added his name. I believe Greenwald saying even up to his own day, but certainly in the 19th century, they added his name to the Yisker prayer. This per se doesn't say so much, maybe, because Prague was always viewed as a very liberal place, and they had Shir, Shomir Rapport as the rabbi there. They always had modern Orthodox-type rabbis there, so it stands to reason that they would respect someone like Kunitz and stick his name in the Yisker. What they did in Prague is that they recited the Yisker, and then they mentioned all the great rabbis who had served in Prague, and beginning with Avigdor Kara, working their way up. I mean, more Gedolim were in Prague than in any other place. And in that very shul, in the Altnoy shul, they all were there. And then they added other important figures, and one of the ones they added was Kunitz. It could be also because Kunitz had learnt in Prague. As we mentioned, he studied with the Note of Yehuda. So here I have Chaim, and... When I say Baruch, they always had modern Orthodox rabbis in Prague. I mean that ever since the Enlightenment. Yes, the Noda Yehuda was not modern Orthodox. The Tshuva Me'ava was not. Rav David Oppenheim was not. Rav Shlomo Lunshitz was not. You're right. Many. However, from the time of the appointment of, from the time of the beginning of the 19th century, and the, especially the official appointment of Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport as rabbi in Prague, from then on until the destruction of the Prague community, they always hired open-minded type, modern Orthodox type rabbis. Heinrich Brody, Chaim Brody was a rav there. He was from the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. Those were the types they hired. And even Shmuel Landau, who was never the official rav of Prague, they never made him official, he was quite liberal. If you look at the way he describes that first you're supposed to do Tanakh and then study Talmud, he sounds a bit like Wesley. And so he was more Haskalah-oriented than his father ever was. But you're correct. When I said always had it, I mean from the beginning of Enlightenment. It doesn't make sense to speak about modern type of rabbis before there were such a thing as modern type of rabbis. But beginning in the 19th century, Haskalah becomes a very important force. The grandson of the Noda Yehuda was a leading maskil. Shir, Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, wins the rabbinate in Prague. He beats out Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, who is the he was the more conservative with a small C candidate, and we know Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, who was very much a religious maskil. We had classes on him. By the way, one of the reasons for opposing Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport was precisely his attitude towards Kabbalah. They didn't think he was sympathetic at all towards Kabbalah. But the only two candidates for this position were the more open-minded types, because the community in Prague, half the community had now become just open adherents of Haskalah. Many people were not religious anymore. They could not have an old-fashioned type of rabbi. They needed a more modern type of rabbi. I mean, just about the Yisfer, just to give you an example of this, that it's really no proof of Kunitz because of being respected by rabbis that he's in the Yisker, because Mendelssohn's name was also mentioned in the Yisker. But Mendelssohn was very respected. Shmuel Landau, the son of the Noda Yehuda, who himself wrote responsa and his great poseg, he respected Mendelssohn. The Noda Yehuda, at least at one time, had respect, and then he didn't really turn so much on Mendelssohn as much as on Wesley. Wesley, he really, for a long time, everyone assumed that this, he really didn't turn on Wesley. Was a rumor, but then it was published about 20 years ago in the journal Kobetz Gedarim v'Yisrael, his attack on Wesley, and he turned on Mendelssohn also. Not because he thought Mendelssohn was a heretic or anything, but as we spoke about, that he thought that the commentary, the translation of Mendelssohn would be a step leading people into studying German, and it was high German, it would be a step to Haskalah. He gave an approbation for a German translation, but he didn't want a high German translation, which was the first step towards Haskalah. And as I said, there were deists, there were atheists living in Prague in the Noda Yehuda's time. He saw the dangers that were out there. But Kunitz, as can be expected, had a great deal of respect for Mendelssohn and Wesley. Wesley, by the way, Naftali Hirsch Weisel, was respected by so many. Although the Noda Yehuda attacks him, so many Gedolim supported Wesley. Even in the mid-19th century, Yaakov Ettlinger, Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, if you look at Rabbi Tsuriel, Moshe Tsuriel, he's published two books, one under a pseudonym, in which he has long introductions quoting all the great rabbinic figures, Yaakov Mecklenburg, the Ksava Kabbalah, many, many others, who cite Wesley and regard him as a very important scholar and sage. Wesley was one of the collaborators with Mendelssohn in the Beis Medrash. In Kunitz's Beis Medrash, he had pictures of on the wall of both Mendelssohn and Wesley. There was a professor at Brandeis University who I knew. His name was Alexander Altman. He was a rabbi in Berlin until 1938, the end of October 38. Then he went to Manchester. He was a communal rabbi in Manchester for 20 years. On his base then was a rabbi named Yitzhak Yaakov Weiss, who at that time was Hungarian rabbi as a dayan in Manchester. Lo and behold, He's appointed head of the Eda Haredit, the anti-Zionist ultra-Orthodox community in Jerusalem. Professor Altman told me that it was a great shock to everyone when he accepted this position, because he had been living among Zionists and modern types. Truthfully, it's not such a great shock. If you read his responsa published when he was in Manchester, he was corresponding with the Satmar Rav and others, but Altman only knew him as a member of his Beis Din. So the idea that he would be going to the Eda Haredit, that to him was a surprise. And in 1958, he comes to Brennus University, professor of Jewish philosophy there, until he dies in 1986. One of the, him and Harry Wolfson and Shlomo Pinnis are the three great scholars of Jewish philosophy in the 20th century. Altman wrote about his father, who was a rabbi in also in Germany. And he says that his father had various pictures on his walls. One of the pictures was the Chasam Sofer, because his father had studied in Pressburg. Not of the Chasam Sofer, but the Chasam Sofer. The other picture was Mendelssohn. So the two who in their themselves could not get along, Mendelssohn, as Chasam Sofer and Mendelssohn, in Rabbi Altman's, in his study, he had a picture both of Mendelssohn and of the Chasam Sofer. And Mendelssohn was regarded as a part of German Orthodoxy. On the 100th anniversary of his death, they had all sorts of celebrations. The other picture he had on in his study was that of Herzl, because this Rabbi Altman, Adolf Altman, who was killed in the Holocaust, he was also a Zionist. So when you think about being an Orthodox Rav, a Pressburg graduate, you have the Chasam Sofer, a German Orthodox Jew believing in secular studies, you have Mendelssohn, and then you have your Zionist, you have Herzl, and he had one more picture on the wall. Actually, he had two more, but I can't remember. I think there were five. I only remember four. The other one was Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. So you have Chasam Sofer, Hirsch, Mendelssohn, and Herzl. And truthfully, these four can't get along on anything. Hirsch is an anti-Zionist. Of course, he doesn't like Herzl. Mendelssohn and Chasam Sofer don't get along. And there's all sorts of conflicts here. But the point of Alexander Altman's essay, it was an essay he published in the Leo Becker yearbook about his father, was that all these different trends were able to find peace, shalom, in his father, who was also, his father was a rabbi in, I can't remember the name of the city his father was the rabbi in, can't remember, it'll come to me. Shlomo asks, Tosfos says that the times of Rav there were those who made, okay, I can't get into Talmudic things now in the class, I'll take a look at that later and get back to you. I'll get back next week. In volume two, by the way, of Hametzarei, his son tells us, that is Kunitz's son, that he has many, many more letters, which he wants to publish. He publishes a small, this is how big it is, not too big, volume two. He never got around to publishing it. And I say these are unique, these volumes, because not only do you have letters of Gedolim, Rabbanim, you have letters of Maskilim, you even have one letter from a non-Jew, a respondent to a non-Jew, which is quite unique, quite unusual, not unique though. The Tshuva Me'ava has a letter to a non-Jew, the censor, and Ramosha Feinstein has a letter to a non-Jew. A letter to Hugh Carey, the governor of New York, about the death penalty. But the difference is that Kunitz and Fleckels are writing in Hebrew to Christian Hebraists. In volume one, number 20, we have another thing which is of significance, great importance. There is a letter here. Let me find it here. A letter from Rabbi Nosson Adler. We have very, very little in print from Rabbi Nosson Adler. Almost nothing. And here you have a letter to Kunitz, to from Rabbi Nosson Adler. Is it to Kunitz? Hold on. Yeah. It's a letter to Kunitz from Rabbi Nosson Adler. Fearing that perhaps people would say is not authentic, because Rav Nosson Adler wrote so little, it's almost nothing what he wrote, he sent the Chasam Sofer the original. And the Chasam Sofer testifies that the signature is indeed that of Rabbi Nosson Adler. So the only example, or one of the only examples of a, he has everything here, of only examples of Rabbi Nosson Adler handwriting, his actual writing something, is found in the Mitzarev. So Talmudic scholars know this very well. Even the Satmar, I think, could find something to like about Kunitz. In volume 2, page 29, he says that an Am Haaretz should not go to the land of Israel because there are many mitzvot he won't be able to do there. This Satmar-like position that going to the land of Israel is only for those very special people who can do all the mitzvos, but certainly people who are not able to follow all the mitzvos. And we're talking about religious people here. This picks up on a position of Rabbi Chaim Cohen, quoting Tosfot, that today there's no longer a mitzvah because how difficult it is to do the mitzvos that depend on the agricultural commandments. But he actually recommends that Am Haaretzim should not go to the land of Israel. The land of Israel is a holy place. And unless you're at that level that you can be sure to fulfill all the mitzvos, the land of Israel is not for you. I guess this is an anti-Zionist position. In Hamitzaref, volume 1, number 11, Rav Elazar Fleckless writes to him, disagreeing with his book Ben Yochai. Remember what the Ben Yochai is. The Ben Yochai is an attack on, or a defense of the Zohar in the face of Rabbi Yaakov Emden's attacks. And we already know that the Tshuvim Le'Ava was not a fan of the Zohar. He has two tshuvot in his Sefer, which deals with this. The other letter which deals with it, which I neglected to include in my article on the Zohar for the simple reason that I hadn't yet gone through the Mitzaref when I wrote the article. But I will be having a post revisiting this issue of the Zohar, citing some new sources, and I will cite this. Elazar Fleckles writes to him that what he thinks is a perfect proof that the Zohar can't be from Rashbi. What does he say? He says that Chazal tell us that bad things don't happen on account of tzaddikim. God does not bring bad things, takalot, to tzaddikim. And there's a famous passage in the Talmud where one of the sages had an animal and he sold the animal to a non-Jew. And the non-Jew couldn't deal with this animal because the animal wouldn't eat because the animal only ate kosher, the animal would only eat the foods that Meisr had been taking, all these sorts of things. So the upshot of that is, God not only watches over the animal, the Jews, he even watches over the pious Jews, their animals. I mentioned that this is cited in my book on the 13 principles. This is cited by the Migdal Oz when the Raivad has his famous response to the Rambam. The Rambam says that anyone who believes God has a physical form, that you're a heretic, and the Raivad says people greater than the Rambam believe this because they were confused about the meaning of the verses. The Migdal Oz can't accept this, and he says that we know that God doesn't even allow the animals of the righteous to err. Certainly, he's not going to allow great tzaddikim and sages to make such a simple mistake that God has a physical form. Fleckless notes that since the rabbis say that bad things do not happen on account of the tzaddikim, yet we know that many people, to use the contemporary phraseology, went off the derech based on the Zohar. He's referring to the Sabbateans, who existed in Prague. There were Sabbateans, there were Frankists and others. He says these people were influenced, they misunderstood, or they were wrongly influenced by the Zohar. How can we attribute it to Rashbi when all these things happened? And I mean, I don't think it's a very strong question. And Kunitz says, first of all, this principle only applies to food. That if a great rabbi postens that something's kosher, we assume that for our purposes it's kosher. But and that's what God was the story with the animal. The animal wasn't eating it. But in other matters, there's no guarantee. People can be led to errors even from the Torah. I mean, it says God created the heavens and the earth. It says the word Elohim, which is plural. So you can be led to think there's two gods. There's plenty of examples of this. So I think Fleckel's point is a bit weak, but it's significant, this letter, and it's the third example of where we see his view about the Zohar. Okay, I just have two or three more tshuvot to do. But I see it's already 10 o'clock, so the beginning of next class, we'll spend 10 minutes, do these three tshuvot, and then we're going to move on to a very important figure. Kunitz, as we mentioned, was a minor figure. Really, if we're here in another 30 years, we would have gotten to Kunitz. But since we did the Chasam Sofer, and since we did the trip to Budapest, I figured I'd do him, because he has some interesting things to say. However, the next figure is a major figure, Rameir Simcha of Divinsk, the Meshech Chachma, the Or Sameach. I don't even know if there's any other figures who are known by two books. You think of the Chafetz Chaim, you think of these figures, the Sri Deish, who we know them by the name of their books. Are there any other rabbinic figures who are known by the name of two books? We refer to Rameir Simcha as the Meshech Chachma and as the Or Sameach, and both of these books are quite important. The Or Sameach was much more important years ago in his lifetime as a Talmudic text, but in retrospect now, looking back over the last 80 years, the Meshech Chachma, I think, has really assumed in the area of Jewish thought and Hashkafah enormous significance. And we'll speak all about that next class when we begin with Rameir Simcha of Divinsk. Okay, so Shlomo says the Ketzos and the Avnei Miluim. How many people refer to the Avnei Miluim? We're going to look at the Avnei Miluim as a Sefer, but to say the Avnei Miluim says, if you're studying the Avnei Miluim, it's once, but I don't usually see it, but maybe. Well, the Netzivos, what else is the Netzivos known by? Known by the Derech HaChayim? I don't think so. But I'm sure there are other ones. But he's the one that, in my mind, sticks out. Baruch asks, and I read it aloud the questions for people who are reading, who are listening without the video. Regarding what I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, the Lisker Rebbe from Hungary, and wondering if there's a Lisker Rebbe today, Baruch tells us that there's one in Borough Park and there's a Lisker Shtiebel in Manhattan. Where's the Lisker Shtiebel in Manhattan? Is that Rabbi Orenstein Shtiebel? Not the Lisk. I don't know where the Lisker Shtiebel is. I know there's a Bionner Shtiebel in Manhattan. The question is, I'm not surprised to hear there's a Lisker, it's on the Upper East Side, that there's a Lisker Rebbe. It would be interesting to know whether this is there's a continuing tradition of a Lisker Rebbe, or, because today I can send anyone who's interested, there's a whole yellow pages published with all the Hasidic Rebbe's today. There's 500-600 of them. You have many people today that have a little bit of a yichus, and they want to be a shtickle Rebbe, so they open up a shul, and because their descendant, or maybe their uncle, their great-great-uncle was Lisker Rebbe, they call themselves the Lisker Rebbe, and it's the Lisker Shtiebel. I'm curious to know whether there's a continuing tradition, though, that before the Holocaust there was a Lisker Rebbe, and after the Holocaust, or this is just something new. So if you can get to that Yorkville. Okay, that's not Blech Shul. It's a different shul. Okay. You believe so. Let's see, Rav Chaim of Brisk said he was much greater than his books. Ah, the Chavastas. Okay, you're right. That's right. The Chavastas and the Nesivos. Well, Rav Chaim, for all his greatness in the books, he didn't seem to put much regard in the books. He never wanted to publish. He was such a perfectionist, and he famously said that what's the job of a rabbi? It's not to teach Torah. It's not to do any of these things. It's to look out for the widow and orphans. That's the job of a rabbi. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik in his city never spoke. He never gave a drasha, not even on Shabbos Agudah or Shabbos Shuvah. He never gave a shir. A few Talmidim would come and he'd teach them privately at a little chevra, a little group there. He never gave a shir to the community. For him, that was not what the job of a rabbi was about. Also, and in terms of the books, the learning was always important, and teaching a few primary students, and before that at the yeshiva, but he never saw it as important to prepare his books for publication, to prepare his ideas for publication. That's an old Brisker thing. No, his books were not published in his lifetime, and he was a big perfectionist. It's a Brisker trait that they're not so into publication. Okay, if you have any, I'll stay on for one more minute if we have any more questions. Yisrael is writing, how did Jewish life in Hungary differ from that in Ukraine and Poland at a time? Was the average person wealthier and more integrated in Gentile society? You can't really speak about Jewish life in Hungary because Hungary was completely different, as we spoke about with the Gustav Sofer. You have certain areas of Hungary which are very Hasidic, which were quite extremist when it comes to secular studies, and then you have other areas of Hungary in the West, close in Bratislava area, in Pressburg area, which they spoke German there. They wore regular clothes, that is, short suits. They received secular education. So Hungary is there's different things going on in Hungary. In the non-Hasidic sections, you had wealth and you had integration. I guess they spoke German, they spoke Hungarian. In Budapest itself, you had that. But the Hasidim were quite different. The Hasidim were very similar to the Hasidim in Poland in terms of philosophy, but the Hasidim in Hungary were more extreme. The Hasidim in Poland eventually compromised on Beis Yaakov. They compromised on the Rebbe compromised on having secular studies in his school in Warsaw. The Hungarian Hasidim refused to be involved almost entirely with Agudas Yisrael because they thought Agudas Yisrael was too liberal. Yes, so Unterland versus Oberland. Did Yaakov Kapel, Reich Kapel Harif have any interaction with today's subject? I don't believe so. No, I do not believe so. I know that you're related to him. That's Kapel Reich number one, not Kapel Reich number two. Kapel Reich number two, if you go to the Budapest Shul today, his seat is still there. He died in the 1920s, if I'm not mistaken. I forget now. I don't think it was in the 30s yet. He was a member of parliament, a rabbi, a member of parliament. But the Hasidim came from neighboring Galicia into the Unterland region, while the Ashkenazic Hungarians were in the Oberland area. And in the Oberland area, they came in from Moravia. What happened was you had these rules on marriage. Only one son could marry in Moravia. Bohemia also. So that was the rule, Maria Theresa's rule, that continued on for many decades, that only one son, until the revolution, until 1848, only one son was permitted to marry. So this led to an exodus of many of these people, and these were not Hasidim, these were open-minded types. Many of them moved into northern Hungary. Hungary, although it was under the rule of the Habsburgs, it did not have this restriction, this marriage restriction. Okay, everyone. Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you all next week. Good night, everyone.